Hello, listeners. This is David Blakeslee, and we are talking at you in episode 143 of the Criterion Reflections podcast. I'm here with my friend Richard Doyle, and we are going to be talking about The Boss, Il Boss, by Fernando De Leo, a great Italian crime mafia gangster director, heartily endorsed by Quentin Tarantino. Perhaps that's the biggest calling card these days, is the fact that Tarantino drew a lot of inspiration from the films we're going to be talking about today. And I say the films, we're going to kind of touch on a couple earlier works from De Leo that were released in 1972, with our main emphasis being on this 1973 film, The Boss. Let's go ahead and get Richard into the conversation. Richard, how's it going tonight?
Hey, it's going great. It's good to be back.
Yes, it is. It seems like it's been a little while, but I always enjoy these conversations as we delve into the nooks and crannies of genre cinema from all around the world. And this is definitely one that caught my attention because it really does exist in the shadow of Francis Ford Coppola's The Godfather, which had been released the year before, and really seemed to just kick off, you know, mafia movies and organized crime movies have certainly been a staple of cinema for a long time, but the mob, mobsploitation, I've heard it called, was kind of a thing. We talked about Bruce Lee and Bruceploitation with our friend Michael Wirth. This is kind of another sort of mini burst of, you know, imitators and variations on a theme. Tell me just a little bit about your experience with Fernando De Leo as we kind of get into our conversation here tonight.
There was some sort of big attention to him when the label that's released these, Raro, started up in the 2000s.
Yeah.
Because one of their earliest releases was the two box sets of De Leo films. And I can't say I'd really heard that much about him. I knew the genre, especially some of the during the sort of home video boom in the 2000s, where a lot of Italian stuff got released, a lot of Italian crime stuff got released, especially by Blue Underground. So I got the two Leo sets back then because people were promoting them very heavily. And I realized then that I had sort of been exposed to him already because he wrote spaghetti westerns before he got into this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he was on the first two Sergio Leone's Fistful of Dollars and A Few Dollars More. I think those were the two that he was like a screenwriter, right?
Yeah. One of three, apparently.
Yeah, and so, you know, he definitely has the formula down of you know, cold-blooded men in difficult situations, you know, a little bit desperate, a little bit driven by greed and ambition, pride, honor, arrogance, all those manly virtues and characteristics on display in these various settings. So whether it's the kind of the dusty old west of spaghetti westerns and, you know, cowboys and six guns and meeting in the main street and shooting each other down, or in the more contemporary settings, these Italian crime films, De Leo seemed to have a gift for just kind of, you know, capturing those ideas and making them pretty striking, pretty evocative films.
Yeah, in a way, this genre seems to have sort of replaced the spaghetti western genre in the Italian sort of popular consciousness. The spaghetti westerns didn't die out completely like in the early 70s, but mostly did. And almost all of the people that end up in these crime genre came from spaghetti westerns. It's sort of an interesting like continuation, bringing the certain kind of action into the modern world.
Well, you know, and you think about a certain kind of action. I mean, yeah, these are our action films. They really do seem to be, you know, custom made for the guys in the audience.
Yeah, so
these are men's movies for sure. The women tend to function more as ornamentation, if you will, and that's certainly the case with The Boss, and a pretty, you know, pretty interesting, memorable performance. But let's maybe build our way up to that before we get to into The Boss. We've both watched the first two films, Caliber 9 and The Italian Connection. They're part of one of those sets. I think that's the first of the two sets, because I think the second set is some of his later films. Is that correct? Am I getting that right?
Yeah, I think this first set, these three are vaguely considered a trilogy because of the Source, and the other three are like three more of his. One of them, I think, is made in the middle of these, but yeah, one of the rulers of the city is made much later than these.
Yeah, I think that was a 76, and that was almost when the genre started turning a little bit into to parody. It's supposedly more of a comedic type of an angle on this, whereas these movies are all pretty dead serious. I mean, there are some things where you laugh because of the shocking brutality and abruptness of the violence, or just the cold-hearted betrayals that go on, but they're not really playing up for laughs in the conventional, funny ha-ha sense. They're just like startling. But yeah, so DeLeo, made his transition, became a director, and as Tarantino says, I think that there's a quote on the very cover of these where he says, DeLeo is the greatest. He's seen all the Italian crime films, and he considers Fernando DeLeo the best of them all. So these are films that, were very formative influences on Tarantino, especially with his earlier films, Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, etc. Do we want to just kind of recap those first two? What were your impressions? I mean, this so-called milieu trilogy. I've read reviews where people have different favorites or supposedly best ofs. What was your take on the three?
Yeah, a lot of when I was, saying on Facebook I was watching these, a lot of my friends said that the Caliber 9 is their favorite of them, which I can't say I share the sentiment. I thought I liked all three of these. Caliber 9, which stars Gaston Motion, I think is how you say his name, the fellow most folks would know from the Godfather Part 2, playing Don Fiducci. I found that one to be like it's the most serious of the three, I think. It's sort of a downbeat, rather sedate film by comparison, in that he's a gangster coming out of jail who's been blamed for the theft of some money that you sort of see at the beginning of the film.
Right,
And
there was a job that they were pulling off, and the loot got it disappeared, and so everybody's wondering where did it wind up, and they're blaming this guy who's protesting his innocence all throughout the film.
yeah, so it basically follows gangsters repeatedly badgering him to give them the money back. And two cops played by Frank Wolf and Luigi Pistilli also trying to get him to turn in the money and also turn in his boss, the American played by Lionel Stander. I found with this one it had some weird plot holes in it. I was always kind of left half wondering what was why certain things were happening in it. I liked the end of it. Let's put it that way. I won't spoil the end of it, but I thought the end sort of saved the whole film for me.
Yeah, I think, and I think as a study of a character, it probably is the most interesting because
Yes.
the journey that he's on and the things that he goes through, that's the, I think, to me, the riveting, and he, it's a good performance as well. We also have
Yes.
to mention Barbara Boucher. I think she had a bit of a career, and this is probably one of her premier roles, would you say? I mean, I haven't seen a lot of her films. I'm familiar with her by reputation a little bit, and she's
Yeah.
the blonde, the dancer. Yeah.
She does some giallos around the same time as this, but I'm not completely clear on the I haven't, didn't look at the like what she did first, but yeah, that's what she's mainly known for and popping up in this one. In the standard role for women in this film seems to be exotic dancing.
Yeah, and quite a lengthy piece. I mean, they really
Yeah.
give her a pretty good share of the spotlight there. It's usually those things happen in little flashes. Well, she's out there for several minutes of,
Yeah.
extended footage there. But yeah, that one I thought was a pretty good introduction. And when I had first heard it was a trilogy, I wondered, well, boy, I'm not really sure where they go to the next film, but the three films really are unrelated, except for the
Yeah.
fact that there's a few actors who make multiple appearances, and they're set in the same kind of general criminal underworld environment. And I guess it's the novel, the kind of the fictional sources that you talked about might be the common thread as well. They're
Yeah, I
kind of
think it's
pulled
a
from the same body of work.
yeah. I think it's a short story collection by I forget his name. It's a very Italian name, but
Yeah.
the first two movies are both based on short stories from it. I thought this one was vaguely like Jean-Pierre Melville, which might be why some people
like You're talking about Caliber 9. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, kind of the stoic, doomed guy who's who knows he's, you know, on his way out, but he's gonna just, you know, stand strong and fight back as long as he can, as long as he has to. And that's kind of, you know, where this story takes us. Just to keep things moving, the Italian connection, that's not a translation of the Italian title. That title seems to be sort of slapped on as sort of a French connection knockoff thing, just to, you know, it was kind of a popular idea and a way to maybe grab, you know, casual viewers' attention. That's the one that's got Woody Strode and Henry Silva as a tag team, if you will, two guys, a black guy, a white guy, and that's supposedly, you know, kind of Tarantino's inspiration for the two guys in Pulp Fiction, Jules and what's the other guy's name, the Travolta character.
Jeez, you know, I wouldn't know this if you didn't ask me.
Whatever, but those two guys,
Travolta,
right?
And Samuel L. Jackson.
Right, Samuel L. Jackson, right, yeah. So the two characters, kind of, you know, partners in crime, and this sets up for the hijinks there. And it's interesting to see Woody Strode, you know, pretty built guy in this Italian, you know, caper film. And he's up against Mario Adorf, who is one of the heavies in Caliber 9. This is Mario Adorf's probably role of a lifetime. You know?
Yeah.
He's definitely a scenery chewer, a pretty, you know, boisterous guy. In fact, that's one of the calling cards of all these films is the Italian style of acting and the kind of the way they just all throw themselves into their roles. Even Henry Silva, who's a more of a stone face, quiet, subdued, you know, he's kind of the other end of the spectrum, but guys like Adorf are just explosive with their temperament, with the physicality of their action, pretty good stunts, but just the ferocious intensity that just comes through, you know, when he gets angry or threatened or is out to prove his point.
This is the one I enjoyed the most.
that's your favorite of the three? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I thought it's not that it's got the greatest plot in the world. It's mm-hmm. very similar to the first one. Adorf gets blamed for a theft, and the pair have come from New York City to bump him off. And
right.
The mob, the main mob guy being Adolfo Celli from Thunderball, is trying to, everyone's trying to rein him in. But this one, I thought, is got some of the most amazing action sequences. The chase in the center of this was astonishing. I actually,
the one where he's on the front of the van, moving in and out. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. This is some very serious. I mean, if you like the, you know, the bullets, the French Connection, big car chases, you know, very physical, you know, stunt work that's very exciting, very enthralling. Well shot, you know, you're like really along for the ride and right up in the middle of it. Again, it's just very impressive, even on the technical level, if you stop and think about, wow, they got a lot of interesting shots, angles, and it's all edited together very seamlessly, so you're just really pulled along for quite a ride.
Yeah. I thought this as pure action, this was the best of the three, and I think sometimes that's what I'm looking for in a film like this.
Yeah, we're not getting into the depths of the human condition or real sophisticated psychological analysis. I mean, it's on the surface, but it's definitely, I mean, these films were all dealing with interesting themes of, you know, life, death, competition, you know, guts and glory, all of that type of stuff.
Yeah. This one might have the best role for a woman. I thought Luciana Paluzzi, also from Thunderball, like they're the mobster's guide.
Okay. Yeah. Refresh me on that. Cause I gave it a one time watch through and I didn't really take away a lot, but tell us about that.
She's the one who, when the two hitmen arrive from New York City, they're paired with her to basically she's just looking after them and showing them around. But
okay,
she's sort of the most normal character that a woman gets to play in these for more than a minute or two. You know, there's wives and girlfriends and things, but most of the female roles are sorely lacking in these. And she at least had She was more than adornment. And she has an interesting sacrifice in the climax, so it's a decent role. She was probably the biggest female star in any of these since she was in a James Bond film.
Yeah, sure. She definitely had that international credibility and exposure. So, do you remember if she was billed prominently at all, or was this just kind of another role that she was just cast into? Oh, actually, she's also on the poster. I do remember that poster where she's laid out very, very alluringly there. So, yeah, okay.
Big spoiler on the poster too,
Okay.
but
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, the junkyard scene, right? It's, well, and they the that poster, presumably the American poster, invokes the Godfather right there in its tagline, you know, when the Godfather puts out the contract or something like that. So, yeah, well, anyways, very, very well endorsed. And I do feel like this is a set I wouldn't mind picking up someday and rewatching these. I watched these films on Canopy. And the reason, of course, we're talking about them is that they were featured on a Fernando De Leo Italian crime bundle on the Criterion Channel. Probably it was just maybe the transfers from that Kino Lorber set, Raro Video, because Criterion and Kino seem to be getting along pretty well as far as, you know, sharing product, Kino's licensed titles on the Criterion Channel for limited edition releases. And that bundle has already come and gone, but it did get its way onto my queue. And I'm really glad that I took the time to get to know these films. I've been aware of them, like I say, in reputation and name. And it seemed like, yeah, this is something that I'd like to check out. So when I saw in my kind of reading up for preparing for this episode that this was part of a trilogy, it's like, oh, I guess I got to watch another trilogy here, which is kind of interesting because as we're on the third episode of this season three, they've all been involving Italian directors with fairly lengthy pieces of work. The Rossellini Age of the Medici is like a 4.5 hour made for TV movie. Luchino Visconti's Ludwig, which was the second episode, that was like a 4 hour when it's in its full, you know, uncut version, which wasn't even seen for a while when it was originally released. Another pretty lengthy study, which was also screened as a mini series on TV later on. And then this one here, these are all, you know, pretty efficient, you know, 90 minutes or less movies. But I wanted to take them all in to get ready for this one. And I think The Boss is probably the one that, since I've spent the most time with it, is the one that I prefer. But it's just because I think it does really capture the essence of that kind of post-Godfather. Let's kind of show different angles on the mafioso. And this is, of course, you know, has the distinction of being, you know, deeply rooted in the Italian culture and society and film industry. So I feel like it does a really pretty excellent job of expanding in some ways, or at least kind of taking a grittier approach to just some of the down and dirty violence that was also a big draw for The Godfather in particular. You know, The Godfather being a film that can be appreciated on so many different levels as a, you know, cinematic masterpiece, you know, just incredible cinematography, acting, the cast, the sweep and scope of the saga, all of that. But it's also a pretty riveting, powerful, you know, grab you by the collar, entertaining flick. If you're just there for, you know, kind of the adrenaline rush, The Godfather will deliver that as well. But this I think goes even further down that road, in terms of, you know, just some of the, you know, the graphicness, if you will, of the whole situation. And it's a little bit more down in the gutter in some ways as well.
Yeah, I agree. This is also, I'd say it's the most cynical one. It's a pretty dark film.
It is, and I think, yeah, I want to talk a little bit about the film's, you know, the aftermath, but let's kind of give a summary. Do you want to give a shot at kind of walking us into The Boss and the basic setup?
Sure. I'll highlight one thing I don't quite understand in it. We'll get there, but
Okay, sure.
so it sort of introduced Henry Silva as a mob hitman who kills a bunch of gang bosses, like mob bosses, at the beginning of the film quite
Yeah.
spectacularly, blows them
Don,
up
right.
over
Donna
and over and
Tardy,
over.
right. Yeah, Donna Tardy, he's having a sort of a gathering. He's rented out a private theater for some you know, screenings of a particular reel that he's brought in from Copenhagen and wants to entertain his friends. and show him a good time. He's feeling his oats and feeling like he's on top of the game there. He doesn't know that there's a dude lurking up in the booth, you know, in the projection room there. So, yeah, it is quite a spectacular kickoff to the film, as he's not just a hitman, but yeah, he's got a rocket launcher and it's just kaboom.
Like four or five times.
Yeah.
You're going, I think he got them the first time.
He was making a statement there. But yeah, so it is. It's a pretty well orchestrated hit, and that gets us right into the just a countless series of double crosses and betrayals.
Yeah. The heart of it is there's a sort of an upstart gang from Milan?
Calabria,
yeah.
Yeah.
Who, in reprisal because one of the people killed was affiliated with them, they kidnap the daughter of a major mobster.
The guy who executed the hit, the guy who commissioned the hit, right? Don Daniello is his name.
Yeah, who's under sort of the boss of bosses in this this play in Palermo. Is this set in Palermo, I believe?
Well, it's a Sicilian family, but I don't think it's on Sicily itself, but you're right. And so Don Carrasco is kind of like the kingpin of this region, but even he answers to higher ups, but they're not really on screen, but you're definitely towards the top of the, you know, the mafia hierarchy, but there's squabbles happening because through government reforms, some of the traditional bosses have been sent into exile, creating a little bit of a power vacuum. And so there's a little bit of a political angle here about, oh, those meddling government reformers have only created more chaos by sort of opening up the field and loosening the tight control that the mobsters enforced.
Right.
Yeah. So Don Carrasco is the guy who, he will let drugs pass through Sicily, but he doesn't want them distributed on the home island there.
Yeah, and he's like the first Godfather connection that's played by Richard Conte, who's in The Godfather playing Barzini. So they don't want to directly, I find this part a little bit difficult to get into.
Sure, okay.
But Richard Conte wants Henry Silva to rescue her, but they want to delay for a while so he can figure out how to rescue her effectively.
Right, because Don Daniello, the kidnapped woman's father, he's ready to just to pay the price. He's cold and brutal and all of that, but all of a sudden they've got my little girl and he's just a puddle of sentimental, you're my baby, you know, I'll pay any price. And Don Carrasco doesn't want that happening because that would basically legitimize Cokie, the interloper who's trying to come in. So he gets all this money, he's kind of earned his place in the scheme of things, and Don Carrasco does not want to allow that. So, but he's afraid that Don Daniello is going to go ahead and give in. So he kind of puts Lanzetta, that's the Henry Silva hitman, sort of on Don Daniello's wing to just kind of keep an eye on him.
Yes.
And that, yeah.
So here's the part I don't understand.
Okay, sure.
So they offer them a huge amount of money in exchange for the girl, really just to delay, right?
Yeah,
like make them think about it, buy some time. And, right, the father's willing to pay all this money and asks Henry Silva to help him.
Right.
Pay the ransom, get his daughter back. And Silva can't do that, so he pretends to and kills him instead.
Yeah, because basically Don Daniello said the three of us, Maione is his right hand man. So Daniello is the godfather to Henry Silva, who was an orphaned kid. You think maybe he lost his parents in the war or something like that. And so Daniello, who's already commissioned Lanzetta to do the hit in the theater against Don Arati or whatever his name is, he basically trusts Lanzetta to help execute this job. He doesn't want to go and pay the ransom himself unprotected. Obviously, he wants to have his enforcer right by his side, but he doesn't want to bring anybody else into it because he doesn't want Don Carrasco to know that they're about to violate his command. Right.
Right. So he kills him. Right.
Yeah, and that's the first cold-blooded, like, whoa.
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
But Dan Henry Silva rescues the girl anyway, and I'm not sure I understand why.
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess if I think about it, I mean, maybe there's a line somewhere in there that I still haven't picked up on, but it seems like maybe it's just to disempower Koki and to sort of spoil their plan, because they feel like they've got some leverage now. But if they get the girl and they don't get the money, then they're still kind of howling and looking for revenge. But you're right, there's not a really clear functional purpose to why would he take this girl, but now the girl's father is dead, so there's really nowhere else for her to go.
Yeah, and they don't really have any leverage anymore with the girl's father being dead. So it's like the proper thing to do would be to tell them, okay, you can keep her because doesn't matter to us now.
Right, right.
Yeah, there's
or you know, because the girl basically just holds up in Lanzetta's apartment for you know once she's rescued, and of course that angle is played up for a different purpose to show the decadence of the youth and this spoiled little rich girl who's you know got her own daddy issues and she's kind of you know run amok. And it does feel to me like this is a film that's kind of coming from the right of center politically.
and that's interesting because I know that generally, not surprisingly, that's sort of the general allegation against this genre, which isn't surprising because it's much that way in the United States too. You know, if you make films about cops or you make films about vigilantes, there it seems like you're starting out a right of center.
Yeah, yeah.
But the two earlier films in this series don't feel like they're coming from the right, you know?
Okay. There's
the long debates between the cops in the first film, where he seems to be on the side of Luigi Pastilli, who's like the left-wing cop.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the depiction of sort of the countercultural figures in the Italian Connection is not unsympathetic.
Right, right.
I don't know that it serves any purpose at all in that film, and that's kind of my problem with him introducing these elements at all. I don't think they serve any purpose in the film, but in this one I agree, she seems like she's like by far the thing I would remove from this film if I had my say. It's a weird digression, and it doesn't really do much except to sort of denigrate the sort of free thinking youth, which feels like left out of left field to me.
Yeah. Yeah, there's this kind of resentment going on, and she's obviously a beautiful young woman, and so the sort of the eye candy aspect is clearly there, and that angle is definitely played up and sensationalized for perhaps they could have maybe gone further with it, but you know there's plenty of that kind of erotic element thrown into it for you know just a little you know additional ingredient in the mix there. I think she actually does a decent job, because you know she goes from the terrified kidnapped ingenue to this creature of lust and passion, you know, and you sort of see her go through that, and she seems you know sporty enough to go along with the role.
Yeah, I have no problem with the actress. She does a decent job, right? I mean, we're also kind of leaving out that she doesn't seem to mind being kidnapped either.
No, it's just another adventure. Exactly. right. Pretty willingly. And so, if I first saw that, it was like, well, we got a little bit of a Patty Hearst thing going on here or something like that. But I think that actually came a little bit later in time, after this movie had already been released. But in any case, so you sort of see... And really, the main attraction here is Henry Silva, this hitman, who you know at first you just think he's just the guy who's carrying out his orders. You know, he's the street waif who was picked up and taken into the good graces of the boss. But that's going to be his role, his destiny, is just a functionary. You know, and he knows that maybe he's even living on borrowed time because of all the. the violence that he's put out there, the lives he's taken, people who are looking for revenge. But he seems to have this aura of like he's the master, he's the untouchable one. If you really have a hard job to get done, he's the guy that you want because he'll make it happen somehow. And you know, his killings are carried off pretty impressively. Obviously, it's all the movies, but he has a great stoic manner about him as he goes about his business.
You know, it's another interesting distinction about him. He doesn't drink J&B. That's you may right. have noticed it's a running joke among Italian genre films that J&B is in like every film, and there
it is
over these films.
Like, right, yeah, that green and the red label.
Yeah, there, but he doesn't drink J&B. It makes him really stand out.
Yes, yeah, but it is that angle of the, you know, the political and the collusion, if you will, the endorsement to a certain level by the police, the police establishment. There's a crooked police commissioner in there. He's actually seen several scenes, you know, kind of given straight up information to some of the underworld bosses. And he's definitely implicated in all of this as well. And that's one of the things that got this film into some trouble, because if we take it all the way to the end of the movie, and we don't have to finish up right this minute, but, you know, there is a to be continued and the final scene. And I don't think that was a false lead. I think, you know, DeLeo maybe still had a story that he wanted to continue telling. And of course you do have, the surviving Lanzetta, you've got a pretty good character established there, and there would be interest to see what has he got next. You know, what's next in his destiny. I don't want to give away where he ends up in the story, but he is, you know, one of the survivors of all of this, and you definitely feel like there's plenty of room for a sequel. But apparently, this film got DeLeo into some trouble with the government, you know, because it did maybe paint too close of a picture, or maybe hit a little too close to home about some of the complicity that was happening between organized crime and organized police and law enforcement.
Yeah. I do. I'll compliment this film. I thought the police are characters in all three films, and in this film, they feel like critical characters, whereas I'm not sure I really felt they were needed in the previous two films. But
we could have just stayed in the mafia world and just let them fight it out there, right?
Yeah, there was a lot of collusion between the mafia and sort of the right wing terrorist organizations that came up in Italy during this period, and those have some fairly critical connections to police. So the allegations in this movie aren't far from true, and I think that's probably why he got in quite a bit of trouble. It reminded me of Damiano Damiani was one of the other big directors of Polizia Teschi films, and he is very much into the police corruption angle. And this one reminded me of that.
So tell me about Polizia Teschi, because that's a word that I kind of stumbled across a few times as I was kind of reading up on this. And my understanding, that's kind of Italian police crime movies or something. But, you know, can you just kind of give us a little sketch of that? Because I wouldn't say I've seen a whole lot of these types of movies, but I'm certainly curious to see other hands give it a try.
Yeah, it's the genre that sort of rises in the 1970s. I think it's like partly response to the fact that a lot of the popular films coming from America were The Godfather, The French Connection, Death Wish, cop and vigilante mob films. So they
Dirty Harry,
Dirty Harry, sure. So that sort of took over one strand of like sort of the Italian genre cinema as the Western sort of died. This genre, which is sort of characterized by very tough and gritty films involving crime, sometimes police, sometimes vigilante, sometimes the mob.
Yeah.
And it lasts, I'd say, until the late 70s when it starts to go into parody, right? But
yeah, sure, right.
DeLeo's big in it. Umberto Lenzi, who had made quite a who also makes some giallo, but makes quite a few ones with Thomas Milian in this era, who was a had was a Cuban who was working in Italy and was transitioned from spaghetti westerns into this genre. And Damiano Damiani, who is probably best known for Americans for having directed the sequel to the Amityville Horror, has this one American film. But he really specialized in this genre too, very political ones. And that's one of the things about this genre. There's a lot of like fairly left-wing political films in this genre, as well as a lot of completely trashy films.
Okay.
Like there's a
Yeah.
huge variety in this genre. I should plug a friend of mine, Mike Malloy, made sort of the definitive documentary on this subject called
Okay.
Eurocrime.
Oh, great.
And that's sort of the
This is a
one.
film that's available out there, or
Yeah, it's called
okay.
Eurocrime, the Italian cop and gangster films that ruled the 70s. He made it in 2012.
Wow. Okay.
And
I'm
it's.
seek that out.
And he's like sort of the expert on this genre, as well as Roberto Curti has written books about it that are he's sort of the other big expert on it. But this is a genre that was kind of because these films are often sort of street level, very Italian, they didn't get a lot of play in the United States until they sort of started to come out in a flood on home video in the 2000s. So although some of these films played in the US and were seen, a lot of them weren't. And that's sort of why it's a less known genre. You know, a lot of them are more sedate and Italian than the kind of stuff that plays well in the States.
Okay. I mean, this to me feels like pretty high end. I mean, and transcultural. You don't have to necessarily even be into, I mean, obviously, if you're into crime films, mafia style stuff, this is a gold mine. But you know, I think these are pretty compelling stories, even if you haven't really been caught up in the whole, you know, allure of the mafia as a as this kind of larger than life, you know, institution, tradition, you know, the secret force that runs the world and all of that type of thing. So yeah, so basically this genre kind of flourished in the 70s. I'm not aware if Criterion has put other types of what's
Polizio Teschi.
Polizio Teschi. Okay, I got to keep working on Polizio
Yeah.
Teschi. But I'm gonna add another section to the show notes. I'll do a little research and maybe throw some of those links in there. I typically do a bit about the director and reviews of the film from other perspectives, but I think I want to. Polizia Teschi. Okay, that's what I'm gonna kind of throw a little spotlight on that and do a little bit of my own self-study here as well. So, yeah, any go ahead.
I'll say the three big labels for like releasing these, like Blue Underground released a lot when they were in their prime in the 2000s,
Okay.
but Raro released a lot of them, which are now like on
Sure.
Kino with their deal, and
Yep.
Severin released some recently. There's a good Umberto Lenzi Thomas Milian box set that was released just like this last year.
Okay,
That's like
good.
four, I think, or three. I just bought it. I should know that. But three or four of these of this genre with those that director and actor combination.
Interesting. Well, yeah, no, I mean, this has definitely been a fun discovery for me, and yeah, it does feel like it's kind of like the Bruce Lee films and that, yeah, and the Bruceploitation that kind of came afterwards. It's kind of fascinating just to sort of see the different branches that kind of grew out of this kind of original impulse here. Do you have any other basic points or things you want to say about the boss?
I think I just say, although I liked the Italian Connection more than it, I think I liked it more just because as a pure action film, that was a real jolt. I wasn't expecting some of the developments in it that happened in the second half. But I would agree this is probably the most serious one and the most interesting from a sort of
Kind of a
plot
structural,
development.
exactly, yeah, and the things that happen. And like I say, the first time through, I don't really want to go too much longer about details because some of the reversals are, you know, breathtaking. And but on second watch, there it's even more entertaining in the sense that you see the construction of how it all fits together. And it's yeah, it's a riveting tale that I think definitely deserves a larger audience. I know in many ways I'm late to the party. There's a lot of probably folks who might have found this podcast who are are already pretty well familiar with these films. But if you haven't checked them out yet, like I say, if you've got access to the Canopy service, which is a kind of a library sponsored streaming channel, by all means, I think they've got maybe some other DeLeo films, but these three that we've been talking about are all on that service, and well recommended, and I definitely look forward to maybe the Criterion Collection getting some more explorations in this genre out there in the months ahead.
Yeah.
All right, and you have the Blu-ray set. Were you able to get into any of the special features? I mean, because that's probably the one thing that still interests me in perhaps obtaining that set at some point. It seems like there's some pretty good documentaries. I don't know if you had a chance to tap into any of that stuff.
I haven't yet. It seems like the first disc is heavily loaded with that stuff, and then it's a little bit lighter on the later
one. Okay.
The only thing I'd point out that was a little bit weird, I had to watch the English dub of The Boss.
Oh.
Because my Blu-ray wouldn't play English subtitles with the Italian track.
Oh, okay.
So that seemed like a flaw on it.
Yeah, that's a little programming error.
But
yeah.
I would point out to folks, most of these films, it doesn't matter which track you pick because neither was shot. Sound wasn't shot with these films.
Oh, yeah.
And it seems like the English-speaking actors are doing their own dialogue in the English track, and the Italian ones are doing their own on the Italian track. So it's
sort
of one and half of the other in a way.
Well, I enjoy the listening to the Italian, even if I don't
know
if I'm reading, just the intonations, especially that one, the police chief. I just love that guy. You know, he always starts off with this slow little unrolling of what he wants to say, and by the time he gets there, he's just, he's basically laying the smack down on his subordinates and reminding them of indeed who is the boss, at least in this precinct. So, again, well recommended, a fun film. And Rich, I appreciate you hanging out with me for 45 minutes to talk about him. All right. So the next film on my queue, I think, is going to be what I originally set out to do, is just a short video coverage. I'm going to do Watt Stacks. Maybe I'll do some musical segments, but that's kind of maybe you could call it a post-Woodstock movie in a sense, and that it's basically a filmed record of a concert. You've seen it, Richard?
You know, I never have, and I always wanted to.
Okay.
I should check it out.
So anyways, that's the next one up, and I've listened to the soundtrack before, and I've watched portions of the film. I've never watched the whole thing through, but this will give me the excuse. And I'm not sure, it's not shown on Criterion, so I'll have to track that down somewhere, and I'll let listeners know where I find it when I get to that next video clip and installment in this series. So for now, I'm going to sign off. Richard, thanks again for joining me.
Anytime.
All right, John. I appreciate you always willing to jump in there. So, okay, listeners, that's it for tonight. Goodbye.